Man who was looking for a hunting dog and read an ad on Craigslist. The ad went, hunting dog for sale, $2,500, but well worth it. So he calls the number, and the man told him that he really had to see the dog in action in order to make a decision. So the next morning they met and went hunting early, and the dog flushed a couple of birds from a clump of bushes. The men took careful aim and bagged both of the birds. And when they fell into the water, the dog walked on top of the water, grabbed the birds, walked back to the men still on top of the water. And the man was amazed, and he bought the dog on the spot. Paid cash. The next day, he persuades his brother to go hunting with him. And they flushed a couple of birds, and once again, the dog walks on top of the water, retrieves the birds, and walked back to them on top of the water. So he asked his brother, so what do you think of the dog? And his brother replied, so you bought a dog who can't swim. Some people just can't find the good, even in extraordinary circumstances. And this is the story today of the man who tried to kill Christmas. It's a strange and bizarre story, and it doesn't seem like it should be in the Bible. It doesn't seem like we should read about it during the Christmas season. It doesn't sound right amidst all the Christmas carols. It doesn't look right surrounded by sparkling lights and candy canes. It takes all the joy away and leaves only sadness and confusion in the middle of this story. And this is kind of a story we would rather just forget about. After all, this 'tis the season to be jolly. Joy to the world. Hark the herald angels sing. Santa Claus is coming to town. I'll be home for Christmas and jingle bell rock. This is the Christmas season. We're listening to Christmas music in the car. How many of you guys, you are already exclusively Christmas music in the car? All right, there's a few of you. Our trees are up. Homes are decorated. Homes are lit on the outside. Okay. Our hearts are full of joy. Come on, that's a gimme. All right, good. We're excited because Christmas is almost here. In your home and in mine, our little children will begin to sneak peeks and even give little shakes to the gifts under the tree in hopes of discovering a clue of what is waiting for them on Christmas morning. They can hardly wait for Christmas Day. It's Christmas and everyone is happy, right? No. We're going to learn today there is one man that isn't happy, that it's Christmas. He's angry about the whole thing, like Ebenezer Scrooge and the Grinch. He would prefer the whole thing just went away. Only here's the catch. This is not a make-believe character. He's real. He hates Christmas, and he's never even heard the word. We're in a series called Searching for Christmas, and today we're going to talk about this man and his relationship to that first Christmas. Only for him, it was more, instead of searching for Christmas, it was more search and destroy. He is the man history calls Herod the Great. His story is told in Matthew, the second chapter. And surely the leader of the Jewish people, Herod, is going to be excited about the arrival of the Messiah, right? And in order to understand Herod's perspective and where he's coming from, we need to go back a bit on his journey. So let's start there. The year is now 47 BC, so it's a good chunk of time before Jesus arrives. Herod the Great is only 25 years old, and he has just been named the governor of the Galilee region, a high position for a young man. And the Romans hope that Herod can bring peace into this region that has been very unsettled, this home of the Jews. And he does bring order, sort of. First thing he does is he captures the bandit leader Ezekias and he executes him, earning the admiration of all the Roman leaders in the area. Next, he marries into the leading Jewish family, the Hasmoneans. And over the next 4 to 5 years, civil war and infighting erupt within the Roman leadership ranks, and Herod keeps positioning himself with those who he knows are going to come out on top. So he's very politically savvy, and he's aligning himself with the people who are going to help elevate his career. So now in 40 BC, the Roman Senate gives him the title and rank of King of the Jews. It was a title the Jews hated because he was not a Jew by birth. He had no connection to the kingship line of David, and he wasn't even a practicing Jew by religion. He just wanted to rule them. And so Rome gave him the title. As the years roll on, Herod proves to be a wickedly clever and cruel man. Like most dictators, he held tightly to the reins of power, and he brutally removed anyone who got in his way. Over the years, Herod killed a lot of people, including his brother-in-law, his mother-in-law, his wife, and three of his own sons. This is Herod's legacy. It was the murder of his wife that drove him mad. He killed her because he thought she was a threat to his power, but he never quite got over that. Imagine that. Even though he was only 44 when he killed her, and even though he lived to be 70, her murder was the beginning of the end for him mentally. You see, above everything else, Herod the Great was a killer. That was his nature. He killed out of spite. He killed to stay in power. Human life really meant nothing to Herod. The historian Josephus called Herod barbaric. Another writer dubbed him the malevolent maniac. That is Herod's description. Perhaps his character can best be seen by one incident a few years before the birth of Jesus. Herod is an old man now. If he was 25, 50 years before the birth of Christ, he's in his late 60s, early 70s at this point, a few years before Jesus is born. Herod is an old man. He's been in power for 41 years. He knows he doesn't have a whole lot longer to live. Word comes that his sons are plotting to overthrow him and take his power. They are sons by his late wife, Mariamne, whom you know he killed her. So her sons are plotting to overthrow him, so he orders them to be put to death by strangling. His wife, his mother-in-law, his brother-in-law, his sons, among hundreds of others, killing was what Herod did best. So now it's 2 to 3 years later. Herod the Great, king of the Jews, is slowly dying. The way Josephus describes his disease leads us to believe it was degenerative and very painful. His body was racked with convulsions. His breath stunk. His skin was covered with sores. He's rapidly losing his mind, but he is still the king. One day, word comes to him in Jerusalem that some visitors have arrived from the east. Strange men with a strange question. These are the Magi, the wise men from the East. They were priests of an Oriental religion who practiced astrology. And in Persia, they were considered powerful, powerful men. They had journeyed across the desert seeking an audience with Herod. They wanted to connect with him and ask him a question. The important thing to Herod was not who they were, but what they asked. And we'll pick up the story now in Matthew 2, verse 2. This is the question they had. Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? Now, knowing Herod's past, knowing his title, you can see where this might be a little disconcerting to Herod. We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. Now, there's a lot of mysteries about this. Who precisely are the wise men? We don't know. How many are the wise men? We don't know. Where did they come from? We don't know. What was this star they saw in the sky? We don't know. Herod didn't know either, but he knew he'd better find out what this was all about. They were looking for someone who was born king of the Jews. How could that be? Herod was the king of the Jews, but he was not born that way. He had to fight and he had to kill to both gain that title and to preserve that title. So what were these men talking about? Even at the end of his life, his concern was not for his kingdom, for his succession, to leave things in good hands. He wasn't thinking about what comes after me. It was to cling desperately to the power base that he had excruciatingly built over time. That's all that mattered to Herod. Verse 3, King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this. Now, the word disturbed means to shake violently. And no wonder. I mean, he was shaking mad at this revelation. I mean, finally, he had subdued all his enemies. He had consolidated his power base. He had killed all of his foes. He was ready to die at the top of his game in triumph. He would go out holding all the cards. Now these strangers come with their strange question. There's no time to rest now. Herod had one more threat to eliminate. He had one more person that he had to kill. Herod knew that the Jews were looking for a Messiah. the one that God would send to save them and reign as king. And I'm sure Herod didn't take that too seriously. But on the other hand, why take chances? Even the concept of some miraculous deliverer arriving on the scene would cause all sorts of problems with Rome and therefore with his rule. Because if the Jews started to rise up, if the Jews started to cause problems, Rome was going to point the finger in one direction, and that was at Herod. So he didn't want there to be any whispers of some Messiah coming on the scene. And that explains what he does next in Matthew 2, 4 through 6. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law and asked, "Where is the Messiah supposed to be born?" "In Bethlehem in Judea," they said, "for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, O Bethlehem in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah. For a ruler will come from you, who will be the shepherd for my people Israel." Now suddenly, things are getting serious for Herod. Maybe these strangers are onto something. What if the baby they are looking for is this Messiah that God promised the Jews? What if? All these scenarios are playing out in his mind. He has no idea what's really going to happen, but doubt has crept in. Herod may be many ugly things, but he is not stupid. So it was time for him to move fast. The wise men had asked, "Where is the baby born king of the Jews?" The scribes had confirmed the Old Testament prediction of Messiah's birth in Bethlehem. So Herod is shaken up. He needs to stop this crazy act of God before it gets out of hand. I said he wasn't stupid. I didn't say he was sane. Would a man really try to kill the Christ of God? Herod did. Like all dictators, he ruled by force, and the one thing that dictators fear most was a force greater than theirs. And they will do anything they can to try to eliminate that. And if the Messiah had come, then it meant that Herod was ruling in opposition to God himself. In his mind, the only option was to kill that baby, and he had to do it now. Herod truly sat out to kill Christmas. So Herod hatched a clever plot. We pick up the story in verse 7. Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. Then he told them, "Go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child. And when you find him, come back and tell me so that I can go and worship him too." Spoiler alert, Herod did not want to go worship him too. Okay, just in case you missed that, want to make sure we're all on the same page. That's not his real plan. So you may read this and say, why didn't the wise men wise up to Herod's trick? I mean, come on. Are they that clear? Well, why would they? They had no reason to suspect Herod's motives in this. They didn't know that Herod wanted to eliminate the child, so they just accepted it. Or you might think this, why didn't Herod send some troops to Bethlehem to check things out? And he could have, but that would have attracted way too much attention. Finally, we could wonder, if Herod was so concerned about this, why didn't he go to Bethlehem and see for himself? And that's a good question. Why didn't Herod go? Because he didn't want to come face to face with the king sent from heaven. That would be too much. He would be forced to make a decision at that point. At all costs, he wanted to avoid that. So he didn't go and send the soldiers. He sent the wise men instead. Because here's the thing. Anytime you come face to face with Jesus, you've got to make a decision. What will I do? How will I respond? There's a choice that had to be made. In this case, he doesn't have to make a choice because he's at a distance. He's just sending other people to do his work for him. So off they went. You know the rest of the story. The star miraculously appeared, led them to the exact house. When they found the baby, they bowed down, they worshiped him, honoring him with gold and frankincense and myrrh. And those three gifts is what lead people to assume that there were three of these wise men, these three kings from the east. And that is the story. The wise men believe something that Herod never did, that this little baby in a tiny house wrapped in rags would someday rule the world. They were not ashamed to give him gifts that were fit only for a king. And just before the Magi step off center stage and drift into the twilight of history, we are told one last fact about them in verse 12. When it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. The Magi went east. Mary and Joseph and the baby went west toward Egypt. Bethlehem was, as it had always been now, a sleepy country village. And if this were a comic book, it would now read, meanwhile, back at the palace, Herod rubs his hands together with an evil cackle. Bonus points if you could tell me what comic villain this is. Anybody? Feel free to shout at me. Boom! There it is. Well done. Yes, that is Brainiac. Herod cannot believe how stupid those foreigners were to fall for a trick like that. But the reality is Herod was the fool, not them. He was a fool to think that he could outwit God. They are gone. So is the child. The plan backfired. He thought to have them do his dirty work for him, but God thought otherwise. And the Bible says that when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became enraged. And before I tell you what happens next, here are some facts to keep in mind. Herod is very old. He's very sick. He's slowly losing control of his kingdom. He's dying and he knows it. He's angry over being tricked by the Magi. He still must do something about this mysterious baby, and he has a legacy of death in his life. In short, he's out of his mind with rage, frustration, fear, and pain. He is insanely jealous and knocking on the door of insanity itself. He's a bloody killer by nature. All the worst instincts of an entire lifetime of cruelty now come to the surface. Keep all of that in mind because it's the only way we can reconcile what is about to happen. In church history, this is called the slaughter of the innocents. After 2,000 years, we remember Herod for this one act, Matthew 2:16. Herod was furious when he realized that the wise men had outwitted him. He sent soldiers to kill all the boys in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, based on the wise men's report of the star's first appearance. He lost his mind and did something worthy of Hitler or Stalin. He ordered the cold-blooded murder of all male babies under 2 years of age. I mean, can you even imagine what that had been like? Can you imagine being one of the soldiers on this death squad breaking into Bethlehem homes in the dead of night, taking these baby boys and carrying out their orders? To one side, the mothers screaming and wailing. They roam the streets and the countryside seeking every baby boy, killing all night long. They had their orders, kill every baby boy. Don't miss one. And they did their job. By morning, the slaughter is over. The soldiers are gone. The babies are dead. And in and around the town of Bethlehem, loud cries of mourning, mothers who cannot be comforted. And how could they be? Their children are no longer with them. Back in Jerusalem, Herod leans back on his couch and hears the news he had been waiting for. All the babies are gone. He can rest now. He has killed his last foe. And the Bible concludes the story by noting the death of Herod in verse 19. Josephus says that when he died, maggots had eaten away part of his body already. He died in agony, insane, tormented, and delirious. When he died, they buried his body in a grave not far from Bethlehem. Not long after that, Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus returned from Egypt, settling in the Galilean village of Nazareth. The man who tried to kill Christmas almost did. Although Herod is the leading figure in this story, he's not the only player on the stage. Besides Herod, there were the wise men, and then there were the scribes, the religious leaders of Jerusalem. All three represent different ways of responding to Christmas, of looking at Christmas, and that's what I want to touch on quickly before we wrap up this morning. The first way is the way of Herod, and that's to search and destroy, and that's hostility. He had this open hostility towards Christmas. Herod stands as a symbol for the kind of world Jesus came into. He represents the world's welcoming committee for the Son of God. It's not the way you thought it would be, is it? Jesus is born and the rulers try to kill him. John 1:11 tells us about it. It says, he came to his own people and even they rejected him. Herod stands for the bloodthirsty, cruel, vindictive side of the world in which we live. The culture that we're a part of. A world where human life is cheap. A world where killing is accepted and even expected. Herod died, but his legacy lives on. To this day, there are those who are offended by Jesus, even by the mere mention of his name. They oppose spiritual truth. They want to erase every trace of Christmas from public life. Herod would be proud of them. I'm guessing there aren't too many of this type of person in the room today. Probably not many of you ascribe to that, if any. If you are, I would love to grab coffee and talk. I'm always open to hear other people's perspective and would welcome to hear yours. But even if this isn't you, there are other ways of responding to the Christ of Christmas besides hostility. The second way is this. It's what I described as, what's the big deal? This is indifference. Here's the thing. When Herod wanted to know what was happening, who did he call for? He called for the scribes and the religious leaders in Jerusalem. These are the ruling authority in Jewish culture in the day where Jesus was born. And so he called them and asked them, hey, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? Hey, what's happening? Hey, can you enlighten me? These scribes represent the religiously indifferent. These are the insiders who know all the facts and do nothing about it. They don't care enough to get excited. When Herod asked where the baby was to be born, here's the thing, they knew the answer. They told him where to look, but they didn't care enough to investigate for themselves. Bethlehem was only 6 miles from Jerusalem. 6 miles. But even that was too far for them. It was all academic. Hope you have a nice trip. If you find the Messiah, let us know. I mean, are you kidding me? To be that close and to miss this? And they knew. They had all the knowledge. They knew what was coming. They knew what to look for. They knew the signs. They knew the prophecies. They were able to recount them to Herod and help him. But they did not care enough to go look for themselves. They should have been singing and dancing because the Messiah had come. Instead, they ignored his birth. So who looks worse in this story? Herod or the scribes? In my opinion, the scribes do. Now, Herod's actions were far worse, but he's at least being Herod. He's true to his own demented, self-serving, pathological code of conduct. He's who he's supposed to be. On the other side, these men knew the truth and did nothing about it. And the sad fact is that many churches today are filled with people just like these scribes and teachers of the law. They know the truth. They've heard the truth. They've grown up with the truth. They could even lead someone else to Jesus, just like these scribes did. They could point the way. Here's how you discover Jesus. But it has never become personal for them. They've never taken ownership of the knowledge that they have been gifted, because that knowledge is a gift. And here's what you need to understand this morning. Truth should never just be information. It should lead to transformation. Truth should never just be information. God help us if we get to the point where we just hear something and say, oh, that's great, but guess what? That's what James says we do. We are hearers of the word without doing it. We forget as soon as we hear it. We turn and walk away. It's like a man who looks in the mirror and sees, and then as soon as he turns away, he forgets what he looked like. And that's what we do with the truth of God. We hear it. We say, yeah, I need to do something about it. And then we go on our merry way. And we forget. It has to lead to transformation. Galatians 6:15, Paul wrote to the church in Galatia, it doesn't matter whether we've been circumcised or not. What counts is whether we have been transformed into a new creation. In other words, what Paul is saying, it's not whether you know the truth. The important thing is not even how well you follow the rules. Because, man, the Jews were great at following rules. But Paul says that's not what it's about. Paul tells the Galatian church that what really counts is, have you been transformed? Are you different? Are you a new person? Have you been, as Jesus told Nicodemus, have you been born again? Are you new? There are a lot of you who have been informed. But have you been transformed? Some people think, I've heard it all. I've been to church. I've done the thing. I do the thing. I'm here every week. Or I'm here the average 1.5 Sundays a month that the average churchgoer in America attends. And yet, there's a lack of transformation in our lives. Here's the thing. We started Trilogy 4 years ago because we wanted to experience new stories, life change. And my question to you this morning is this. Have you experienced a new story through the transformative power of God? Have you gotten close enough to Jesus? Not the story of Jesus, but the person of Jesus, to become a new person yourself, the person God designed you to be. Maybe you need to do a little searching yourself this Christmas season. Invest some time during the holiday rush to experience for yourself the Christ of Christmas. Because here's the other reality. You will never find Jesus if you don't look for him. You won't. Herod wasn't looking for Jesus. For thousands of years, the Jewish people had been anticipating the arrival of the Messiah, the one who would deliver them permanently. Many even believed he was coming to free them from Roman imperialism. But Herod didn't want things to change. He was happy the way they are. I just described most people in our culture today. We don't want to change. We're okay. And if you're not searching, you're not going to find anything. Jeremiah 29:13 tells us how it is. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. God has promised that anyone who goes seeking for him, for truth, will find it. But there's a condition attached. You've got to want to find it. You've got to look with everything you've got, with all your heart. There has to be a willingness in the search. Herod didn't seek with his heart. He went looking with his agenda. He wasn't open to the truth. He only wanted to fulfill his own desires and plans. And some of you have been searching for God, and you still haven't found him. And here's my challenge. Could it be that instead of looking with your heart, you're looking with an agenda? You're looking for what you want to find instead of for what the objective truth is. You're convinced that God is vindictive, and so you find negative circumstances you choose to attribute to God and ignore any examples of his love you encounter. You think God can't change anything for you, so you're drawn to those following Jesus who live openly hypocritical lives and proclaim that it won't work for you either because it didn't work for them. It's time to set agenda aside. Set aside our preconceived notions and go looking for truth. To be willing to accept Jesus for who he really is and to have a personal experience with him. Let the truth lead to transformation in your life, a genuine new story. Chrisanne, if you would come. As we come to our last element, our last way to respond to Christmas, we had Herod, we have the scribes, and now finally we have the wise men. And the way I describe that is we've found what we were looking for, and that leads to worship. One final group, the wise men, who when they found the baby, they bowed down and they worshiped him. It's an ironic twist in this story that it is the pagans who recognize Jesus for who he really is, and the people of God ignore him. Herod knows and tries to kill him. The scribes know and ignore him. But the wise men proved themselves worthy of their wise name. When they found him, they worshiped him. They honored Jesus for who he is, the Son of God, the Messiah, God who is with us, and they worshiped. The ultimate question is how you respond to Jesus. Because when we come face to face with Jesus, we have to respond. We have to decide. And that's really the only thing that matters. Are you with Herod? Or are you with the scribes? Or are you with the wise men? Are you hostile? Are you indifferent? Or are you a worshiper? As I read Matthew 2, one fact strikes me above all others. Everybody involved had the same basic information. They all had the same facts. The knowledge was there for all of them. They all knew a baby had been born in Bethlehem. They all knew who the baby was. Herod knew and tried to kill him. The scribes knew and didn't care. The wise men knew, and they worshiped. And if information alone could save you, then even Herod would have been saved. But information alone cannot save you. It's not what you know, but what you do with what you know that saves you. If you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God from heaven, if you believe that Jesus Christ is the promised Messiah, if you believe that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world, if you believe that Jesus Christ came to save you from your sins, if you believe that Jesus Christ died on the cross in your place, if you believe that Jesus Christ rose from the dead, if you believe that Jesus Christ ascended into heaven, if you believe that Jesus Christ will one day return to the earth as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, if you believe all of that, then do what the wise men did. Open your heart, bow down before the Lord Jesus, and worship him. As the Christmas hymn says, come and worship, worship Christ, the newborn King. And here's what I want to challenge you with, because everybody in the room is like, okay, we're getting ready to sing a song. No, we're not. Because your worship is not a song on Sunday morning. That's a part of worship. But your worship needs to be daily, hour by hour, minute by minute. Worship Jesus through living the transformed life that he was born and died to redeem for you. That's what we're called to. The problem is there are many people who believe that Jesus is the Son of God, believe he's the promised Messiah, and on and on and on of those statements that I read. And they go on living a mundane life, refusing to allow the Holy Spirit to transform them. Each week, I pray that we would leave this place a little bit more like Jesus. That's really what the Christmas story is about. Jesus didn't come just to invade our timeline, just to put in 33 years and then head back home. He came to show us the way. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He's not just the way. He's not just a path to heaven. He's the way. He's the way we are to live. He's the transformed life that we should be looking to experience and live and share with those around us. Herod's crown and authority were everything to him. Herod wasn't willing to surrender. And the question I have for all of us this morning, and we need to ask ourselves an honest question, am I willing to surrender? Because you can't worship Jesus until you're ready to get off the throne. And there, the throne doesn't get piecemealed out. It's all or nothing. You can't give almost everything to Jesus. You yield. You surrender. And that's not a scary thing. It's the best thing we could ever do. Jesus entered our world as one of us 2,000 years ago. God's plan for our redemption was revealed in the form of a helpless baby born to Mary and Joseph in an animal shelter. But that baby was a king. More than that, he was the king. And it's time for us to get off the throne of our lives and let the king take his place. Would you bow your heads with me this morning?